Welcome to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm health integrationist Lena Berman with Jeff Fawcett, PhD. We come to you weekly with a critical, independent voice on the politics and practice of health. I think most listeners are already aware of the short-sighted cruelty of cutting social programs when the economy is in a downturn, and to do this to bail out our banks. What may be less obvious is the cost in health. When people are helpless and lose hope, it causes ripples across society that affect the economy, and down it goes again. Health isn't the absence of disease. It's a balanced ecology that sustains the bigger body. Throw off the balance, and there is a great cost. And here's another clue. Money doesn't buy happiness. Today we'll be examining the relationship between health and the economy. First, an editorial or a commentary by Dr. Jeffrey Fawcett.
Thank you, Lena. Researchers at Baylor University in Texas found that when people are too generous, they are punished for their generosity. People are also punished if they're too stingy. The trouble is nonconformity and what one of the researchers called the power of norms. This made me think of Tom Jefferson, an English epidemiologist who works in Rome on infectious disease. He was asked by the drug company Roche to evaluate the research on its Tamiflu product in the build-up to a swine flu epidemic that never materialized. An honest scientist, Jefferson asked Roche for all of the clinical data trial. When Jefferson refused to sign a confidentiality agreement, Roche denied him access to the proprietary data. So Jefferson went on ahead with the data that he had that was publicly available and found that there was no evidence that Tamiflu improved the outcome for flu patients. This launched him on a path that questioned quite a bit about the seasonal hysteria and very big business of flu vaccination. Because of these important discoveries, he was an outcast within the infectious disease research community. That is, he was punished for his failure to conform. To judge by a big article in the New York Times about Dr. Jefferson's colleague and collaborator Peter Doshi, the punishment hasn't stopped either of them. The topic of the article is not just the critique of vaccination, but the ability of researchers to get hold of all the clinical data held by drug companies like Roche, companies that have denied access on the grounds that the data is proprietary and would put them at a competitive disadvantage. While drug companies haven't yet lost, more and more of them are releasing previously sequestered data to researchers, which also means to the public. Although I'm sure they don't think they're whistleblowers, but I think Dr. Jefferson and Dr. Doshi qualify. They reveal the misconduct and dishonesty of drug companies and public agencies when these organizations tell us that, for example, Tamiflu is very effective, or that 36,000 people die each year from the flu, and that if only they had been vaccinated, those who died would have survived. For this, they are punished. Not with life in prison or self-exile to foreign soil, yet they're still punished for revealing misconduct and dishonesty. As admirable as the work of these medical whistleblowers might be, it leaves us at the mercy of the power of norms. Tom Jefferson and Peter Doshi are nonconformists of a fairly mild kind. They're working diligently to make the drug companies and the CDC and the FDA honest. But that leaves us stuck in the world of drugs. There are alternatives. As alternatives to drugs, there are herbs and homeopathic remedies, for example. From the standpoint of the dominant system of health care, these are very, even wildly, nonconformist. And we see that plainly in how they are punished. No self-respecting or career-respecting researcher would propose, let alone get funding for, a research project that honestly compared the efficacy of pharmaceutical, herbal, and homeopathic treatments. Yet even this is quite limiting, in my opinion. It traps us in the universe of alternative forms of magic. What pill makes you larger? What pill makes you small? Research on how viruses make us sick show that not only influenza, but other viruses, such as West Nile and dengue, hijack aspects of the host's immune system, specifically several varieties of interferon. Interferon is an element in the innate immune system, which is our general purpose first line of defense against invading organisms. So when the innate immune system is weak, the body is more vulnerable to viral attack. The dominant mode of health care against viruses is vaccination, which exposes the body to the virus in a dose that will provoke an immune response. Unfortunately, this is a response of the adaptive immune system. In other words, it creates antibodies. What I just said is that the dominant approach, the norm, into viral infection is all wrong. Innate immunity should be the focus of attention. To that extent, herbal and homeopathic remedies are likely superior. But that's not the path I want to follow. If supporting innate immunity protects against viral infection, what supports innate immunity? Not vaccination. Vaccination uses adaptive immunity, not a drug. What supports innate immunity is social justice. A recent study in the open access journal PLOS-ONE found that social injustice and inequity in income, education, and race, all manifestations of the power of norms, weaken a child's innate immune system and increases the incidence of infectious disease, not just for the child, but for the adult into which the child grew. Let me say this more strongly. Social injustice and inequity cause the flu and other viral infections. So if the CDC is serious about preventing viral epidemics, it should make sure that our children are well-fed, well-educated, well-housed, and free from discrimination. A transcript of this is available at yourownhealthandfitness.org. I'm Jeffrey Fawcett. Take care of yourself.
Dr. Jeffrey Fawcett's a political economist, writer, and health educator who produces this show with me and is primary author of our book, Too Much Medicine, Not Enough Health. Now to today's topic, which is why austerity kills, and my guest today is Dr. Sanjay Basu, who is a PhD and an MD. He's an assistant professor of medicine and an epidemiologist at the Prevention Research Center of Stanford University, and he is a former Rhodes Scholar. He lives in San Francisco, California. His co-author is David Stuckler, who is a public health doctorate in public health and also has a PhD and is in England and was unable to join us, but we're very happy to welcome Sanjay Basu. Their book is The Body Economic, Why Austerity Kills. Welcome to you, Dr. Basu.
Thank you for having me.
I may need you to speak up just the tiniest bit. So one thing that I thought was very interesting reading your book is it would seem obvious, and it's not. Do economic downturns always result in poor health outcomes and disease?
No. In fact, for many years, people have described life expectancy increasing during recessionary periods really as an artifact. For example, when people have less money in their pockets and gas prices are high, there's less road traffic, because people can't afford to drive, and there's less road traffic accidents. So classically, the decrease in traffic accidents causes overall death rates to actually decline during recessions for the most part. But we found that hidden behind that decline in traffic accidents were a lot of other variations that had more to do with local policy responses to recessions.
So less money, less cigarettes, less alcohol, less cars. Basically.
Not always. In fact, what we see is divergence. The cars tend to be more universally used less. But in terms of alcohol, for example, or cigarettes, the average rates decline in use, but actually there's a marked divergence. For example, in the United States, while many people bought one less two-buck chuck at Trader Joe's during the recession, there was a very significant group of young men who were either unemployed or couldn't find a new job who started binge drinking, over 700,000 of them in the United States. Mm-hmm. And so using average rates is really deceptive. You have to look at the detailed disaggregated data and find that there's a lot of vulnerability during the recessionary period.
Reading this book, it's very clear that the two of you, Dr. Basu and Dr. Stuckler, are extremely passionate about this topic. And one of the things that you do that makes this topic accessible to people is you delve back into the past. And what we find in the past is some really brilliant examples of how to make this work without making it worse. In other words, when the economy is bad, how to uplift everything without causing everything to sort of uplift and then collapse. So one of the examples that you use early on is what happened in Louisiana under Huey Long, where he improved the public health. There were less infectious diseases, even without antibiotics, and there was housing and less people killed themselves. So do you want to give us a little bit of a background about how that worked and as a good example?
Mm-hmm. What we try to do is study so-called natural experiments where different communities that are otherwise similar experienced the same recession and had different policy responses. And then using a number of well-accepted statistical techniques to control for pre-existing conditions and differences in the community, we looked at what the independent effects were of the differences in policy. So one of those natural experiments occurred during the Great Depression, where different counties and states enacted to different degrees components of the New Deal. And doing all the statistical control, you see those counties and states which enforce the New Deal policies more aggressively, having dramatic improvements in public health as compared to those who did not enforce the New Deal. And you don't see that being a sort of reverse causation, that those communities that had recovered already economically had then subsequent improved health, but the other way around, where you have very clear pathways to investing in health through stimulus rather than undergoing austerity measures, actually reduced public health negative outcomes such as hunger and infectious diseases that are pretty clearly linked to, for example, overcrowding in housing or vaccine-preventable disease. And conversely, the austerity regions had better short-term budget deficits, but over the long term had reduced their stimulus so much that they end up with a longer-term debt. They essentially had further crises with decreased consumer spending, decreased employment, and more protracted longer-term deficits and recession.
Since we've mentioned the New Deal, it's worthwhile to talk about FDR, and he's been discussed a lot. Certainly during the Obama campaign, it was looking as though he might employ some of these ideas, but in fact, not so much. But it's interesting that FDR actually had to be pushed a little bit to do it. It wasn't like he just came into all, you know, he was campaigning on it. If I understand your book correctly, it was because he was actually afraid of losing that he brought this in to the campaign. Am I right?
That's correct. Looking at the historical record, as described by many independent historians, reveals that, in fact, FDR was facing pretty significant labor movements that were disgruntled and were pushing the vote increasingly towards the left at the time and towards greater social protection systems. So in some ways, the New Deal was very much a response to electoral politics.
And oddly, he became the most popular president in history because of the New Deal. So it's fascinating that happened. Just to let you know, you're listening to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman on the phone with Dr. Sanjay, S-A-N-J-A-Y, Basu, B-A-S-U. He is an MD, PhD at Stanford, and he has written with Dr. David Stuckler the book The Body Economic, Why Austerity Kills, Recessions, Budget Battles, and the Politics of Life and Death. You know, another person from the past that had the right idea, I think, in my opinion, and I think judging from your book, in your opinion, too, was JFK, was Bobby Kennedy. Actually gave a remarkable speech where he discussed the dangers of austerity measures. Do you want to?
Indeed. Kennedy at the time was really highlighting was a confusion between the means and the end. That is, all too often we are so infatuated with what will contribute to economic growth that we forgot that economic growth is really a proxy and a means towards a more important end, which is our community and our own family's well-being. And he highlighted that in a speech in March 1968, in which he quite explicitly noted that the gross national product doesn't just capture important economic productivity, it also counts air pollution and cigarette advertising and ambulances to clear our highways of carnage. And what it does not do is allow for the health of our children and the quality of their education or the joy of their play. And as he said, it measures everything in short except that which makes life worthwhile and can tell us everything about America except why we're proud that we are Americans.
Unfortunately, when Russia began to move away from communism and go through this transition, they didn't learn any of these good lessons that America had learned, well, which apparently still hasn't learned, but that were available as examples of how to deal with downturns and whatnot. So Russia just dove headlong into a complete disaster. And I think part of the reason was this concept of shock therapy, you know, this approach to austerity, which led to unbelievable alcoholism and a very dramatic early death among young male factory workers.
Indeed, during the collapse of the Soviet Union, we again had a similar natural experiment. Very similar populations all underwent the same recession at the same time, and different sub-states and sub-regions had governments that decided different policies. And Russia, for example, underwent the severe shock therapy, which meant really dramatic privatization very rapidly, and the cutting of safety nets in particular. For example, the anti-alcohol program, or programs that were related to the improvement of the welfare for the unemployed, unemployment insurance type schemes. By contrast, Belarus and other similar countries that also went under the transition decided to undergo the transition gradually with safety nets in place. And again, the same irony took place in which the countries doing the gradual approach and the stimulus approach actually ended up with faster economic recovery, but also in the process avoided some public health disasters, of which a dramatic rise in alcoholism was one. And really one saw perhaps the most shocking example of young men experiencing a spike in death rates, perhaps one of the largest spikes that have ever been observed in human history outside of wartime.
Well, they were completely hopeless. They had no work. They had nothing to do. They started drinking. Then they couldn't afford vodka, and so they moved on to forms of alcohol that they could buy that were not intended for drinking. So the death rate not only went up, but the life expectancy for Russians went plummeting down. It was really astonishing. And as you say, Belarus didn't follow that, and their outcomes were better, and they're still better today, although Chernobyl has destroyed the IQ of their young people, the radiation. There are other health consequences, which you've mentioned. Infectious diseases go up, and there was also a lot of tuberculosis. So things that hadn't been, you know, in sort of so-called modern society, hadn't been out of control, sort of became out of control again, like TB.
Indeed, we see that now today. Tuberculosis happens to be a subject of my research specialty, and it was called by the CDC not long ago because in Florida, where austerity measures in terms of budget cutbacks are affecting local public health departments, those public health departments that have been differentially cut rather than stimulated have experienced some rather dramatic results. For example, there's now a tuberculosis outbreak in Jacksonville in the context of the TB public health department budget being cut.
We're also seeing a dramatic rise in HIV infections worldwide, and it appears that the IMF is kind of going around advocating shock therapy all over the place to all these other countries. So Thailand is one example where HIV just, it was a complete disaster in Thailand, and the shock therapy and the HIV rates went really high. And this in contrast to Malaysia, that controlled market speculation and fund exchange rate and expanded the food support programs for the poor, and all to good effect.
During the East Asian crisis of the 90s, we actually had an interesting parallel to the current recession, which was the East Asian crisis was also similarly fueled by a real estate bubble. Indeed, it was said that so many apartments were built in Bangkok that you could house the entire population multiple times over in these apartment buildings that were just empty, but people were making a lot of money creating a price bubble in the real estate market. Actually, if you go back to the Great Depression, you see a similar result well before Black Tuesday in terms of a lot of housing bubbles. But indeed, under a lot of pressure, Malaysia decided to take a different turn. To some extent, South Korea decided to take some stimulus, and you again see them recovering more quickly. Thailand, which was once the model country for HIV prevention, ended up slashing its HIV budget along with a number of other public health budgets and experienced a sudden doubling of the infectious disease death rate, not corresponding to the recession, but actually corresponding to the austerity measures, and specifically in those sub-regions where austerity was enforced and not in the contrary regions of the country. And so you again saw a large natural experiment. The IMF's role was actually fairly interesting. Initially, they were indeed advocating for dramatic austerity. But as in today's recession, they reversed their policy and actually issued a formal apology for austerity. And we again saw that with Greece, where initially the IMF was, along with the European Central Bank, really dramatically enforcing austerity, and then turned around and said, oops, we should have really recommended quite a different policy.
One of the things that you mentioned as you were discussing all of this is that rushing into privatization is one of the problems. And privatization doesn't speed up the economy. It can cause it to drop even further down, this rush to privatization. And another example that gradual is better is China, China's approach.
Indeed, this is a common contrast in the public health and the economics literature. And one of our concerns is, you know, as a statistician, we first look at the data and then draw conclusions. And what we see rather dramatically is the opposite taking place with a lot of these initiatives. That first, there seems to be an ideological conclusion being made, and then the data are often either ignored when inconvenient or are forced to fit with the already decided upon conclusion, even when it's dramatically at odds with the data.
One of the most amazing examples, as you say, one of the most amazing studies, the unintended study that was done is Iceland. And it's one of the reasons that Iceland, along with the results, along with what happened being amazing, is just that Iceland is easy to study, and maybe you should explain why that is.
Yeah, it's rather dramatic that we were talking almost daily about Iceland in terms of how bad the recession was in Iceland, and then we turned the news cycle over to Greece and sort of forgot about Iceland. But Iceland actually experienced the largest recession in recorded history relative to the size of its economy. All of its major banks failed. And they did something rather dramatic. When recommended to undergo an austerity program by the IMF, Iceland's ministers actually said, we don't think this is going to be sustainable. And in particular, we're in the middle of a liquidity crisis, by which I mean the banks are shut down, so businesses can't employ people, they can't continue to maintain their business, and so we need a stimulus so that we maintain employment and consumer spending and grow ourselves out of the short-term deficit and prevent long-term debt that way. That's standard macroeconomics, in spite of the common misconception that short-term spending would somehow reduce deficits. It's actually quite the opposite of macroeconomic teaching. And Iceland did something rather dramatic, which was put this to a democratic vote. People actually voted that they would bail out their private banks slowly rather than all at once through public sector safety net cuts. And in doing so, they maintained their status as actually one of the happiest and healthiest countries in the world. In spite of having such a large recession, they recovered rather dramatically and quickly, although that hasn't been very widely reported. Iceland actually had a larger initial recession than Greece, and while Greece, through the austerity measures, continued to have a worsening recession, Iceland recovered to the same growth rate as 2007 as quickly as 2012. And we couldn't find any indication of negative health effects in Iceland. In fact, there's only one spike in emergency room visits in week 52 of the recession, which corresponded to the volcano eruption and respiratory distress in the context of the volcanic eruption, which, of course, is not really the consequence of an economic policy choice, as far as I know. So it's a rather dramatic case study.
Well, also dramatic and also interesting because of the nature of the place, which is it's very controlled. I mean, you've got a small... It's an island, and you've got a population of people who are remarkably similar. So you're not dealing with ethnic, you know, a lot of ethnic differences and cultural differences and whatnot. You've got this group of people who are relatively similar, you know, obviously not exactly the same. And to say that they put it to the vote is... in your description in the book, it's very much more dramatic than that. What actually happened is that the citizens really forced the government not to bail out the bank.
Mm-hmm.
And there was somebody, one of the government people made a very funny joke comparing the IMF to vampires, saying that the difference between the IMF and vampires is that vampires actually stop drinking when you run out of blood. So, the people hit the streets and it worked. I mean, that's really dramatic given all the things that we've been seeing in all these other places where people hit the streets and they get shot. This actually worked. And another thing that you might want to say more about is you and Dr. Stuckler actually presented your data to them. And I wonder how that went and whether or not that had, what kind of an effect that had on their decisions.
Indeed, Iceland is a special case because it is such a small and homogeneous country, and so it's nice to study as a scientist. It's also notable that places that are more ethnically fractionalized, in the sociology term, or you could just say racially diverse, seem to have less problems in terms of making these kinds of dramatic democratic decisions, and it's a great concern of ours in public health and sociology how in places that are increasingly ethnically diverse we see people voting for meaner policies, one could say, in terms of social safety nets. So Iceland has quite a different atmosphere. In fact, it's such a small and tightly knit place that a lot of people go to these baths together with a lot of indecent exposure in the process.
Or decent exposure, depending on your...
Yeah, I guess I'm from San Francisco.
Yeah.
I should say decent. there's a high degree of social capital in that sense.
Yeah, no.
When we presented our results, it was almost like presenting to a group of people for whom these results are entirely obvious, which was quite a contrast to presenting in the United Kingdom, for example, where under the Conservative government currently, the idea of social safety net is essentially a bad word, and there's a strong emphasis on reducing, you know, quote-unquote welfare queens and so forth, in spite of how little data supports these ideas.
I need to break very briefly for a brief musical break. When we come back, we'll continue this interview. I'm Lena Berman. This is Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm on the phone with Dr. Sanjay Basu, BASU, MD, PhD. He and his co-author, David Stuckler, MPH, PhD, have written The Body Economic, Why Austerity Kills. And we'll continue this interview right after this brief musical break. So please stay with us while we discuss this some more. Thank you.
I
Welcome back. This is Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman. I'm on the phone today with Dr. Sanjay Basu, who is co-author of The Body Economic with David Stuckler. The Body Economic, Why Austerity Kills, Recessions, Budget Battles, and the Politics of Life and Death. We were discussing Iceland, and I don't want to walk away yet from Iceland. I want to just briefly go back to it. You had mentioned the happiness quotient. The happiness index is very high, partially because of the society and the way it's put together, you know, the fact that they bathe together and things like that. But they're also, they also had a different kind of social, they had a higher level of social programs and things like that. And in addition, another thing that happened was that in spite of, you sort of mentioned this, but I'm just trying to fill it in a little more because I found it so remarkable. In spite of the economic crisis, actually citizens felt better and had more leisure time because they weren't working as much. So their happiness index went up. McDonald's pulled out because of the cost of doing business and not making enough, et cetera, et cetera. So their diets improved. They had better health for that reason. They had less money. They were drinking less and they were walking around more. Can you give us an update on the status of the banking crisis in Iceland? But when you finished your book, there was some question it was going to the courts.
Mm-hmm. That's where it remains. And a lot of investors in the banks in Iceland are still suing in order to get Iceland to pay back these private banks or the creditors in the Netherlands and the U.K. They had all invested in this scheme called IceSave, which had been this banking scheme in Iceland when Iceland decided that rather than continuing with their more traditional fishing and tourism economies, it would try to enter into a kind of Cayman Islands-like set of banking schemes. And those had invested in U.S. mortgage-backed securities. They were offering extraordinary interest rates for common bank accounts. And, of course, everyone was pleased to be getting those interest rates without asking too many questions. But those who had invested in them after the mortgage-backed securities collapsed are now suing in order to get their returns. The Icelanders had voted to court it, sort of have a delayed and progressive payback scheme to pay back the debts and the mistakes of their bankers, unlike Greece, for example, which enacted public sector cuts to pay back the private debt.
Actually, if we compare Greece and Iceland, it's pretty dramatic because Greece is kind of the worst case scenario almost.
There are some notable differences politically. In particular, you know, Greece is part of the Eurozone and was so much more constrained than Iceland by the various politics of the European Union, and so in some ways it's an unfair comparison. But it is sort of goes to show that recessions don't inevitably lead to bad health. That's really what our point is in making the comparison between the two.
So can you say more about the sorts of mechanisms behind the scenes between, you just talked about a little bit of it, between a place like Iceland and a place like Greece? I mean, we do have some Asian countries I have to remind myself, unfortunately, like Malaysia, that didn't fare as badly. So you're saying that there are constraints because Greece was part of the European Union? Is that what you're saying?
Yes, exactly. As part of that, really, Greece had only a few major options for what to do when its banking system and its industry and demand collapsed. What had happened in Greece is a bit different from Iceland. It wasn't so much a banking crisis as a series of problems that were initially caused by some Greek politicians who wanted to desperately become part of the EU. They had actually, as is well known now, hired Goldman Sachs to essentially help clean up their financial data. And the European Union auditors had kept catching Greece for what looked like fraud. They used these computer algorithms to catch Greece policymakers who had cooked the books and typed in a bunch of inflated numbers. And Greece actually hired Goldman Sachs to essentially fix that. Goldman Sachs has done such a good job of covering up the fraud, really, that the data passed a detailed financial review by European Union auditors, although now it's been caught again in retrospect. And but, of course, this is not the problem of ordinary Greeks. This was something that was done by a group of elites. And there are a lot of false claims made about the Greeks and how they were all on welfare or they were all not working and getting paid a lot on the state budget roll. I'm not sure exactly where how this got promoted, but just the raw data from reliable peer-reviewed sources doesn't support this at all. For example, the average Greek actually works more hours than the average German, and those are real working hours by independent auditors. They're not sort of sitting around kind of thing. The same in terms of percent on welfare and so forth. The real problem was that Greece's economy was really highly dependent on the rest of Europe in terms of tourism dollars. And as that shrunk in the context of the stock market crash precipitated by the U.S. mortgage-backed securities crisis, really there was a lack of available funds in Greece, and the elite class had been foregoing tax payments for quite a while. There's a tremendous amount of tax evasion on the part of the highest income crowd. And so essentially you had no revenue and nothing to do in order to fund the public system. It's the same thing that actually happened to Germany after World War II, and of course Germany was bailed out, as we all know, in part to the United States. And the same thing that happened to Texas during the savings and loan crisis of the 80s, and actually Texas was bailed out by the rest of the United States. But in this context, Germany actually had decided, along with the European Central Bank and the IMF, that it would be better to dramatically cut the public system. And they did provide a bailout, but as investigated in, by a series of New York Times investigators, the actual money was going through Greece back to German and other European creditors. So it wasn't really funding the Greek system, and it's still not. The money is sort of traveling to Greece and then being going back to private investors who had lost money in Greece at the time.
I think the most dramatic thing that comes through in your book is the countries that had, you know, you mentioned this thing about Greece being accused of having too many people on the bail. I mean, we're hearing this in this country now. You know, oh, so many people are getting food stamps and this and that. And then when analysts actually look at the data, what they see is that food stamps and social programs actually stimulates the economy. So we see Greece, you know, with being accused of this and being under the onus of the European Union, and then we see these other countries that are more the island economies, where there are more to themselves, who have better, well, and also Scandinavia, have better social programs, and the outcomes are better regardless. So one of the things that's huge is this misunderstanding and confusion that social programs and so-called welfare is it draws and draws down the economy, and that you can't have that. You have to have people. This is also in the absence of work stimulus programs. But in any case, if you could speak about the really short-sightedness of cutting social programs and not giving people food and health care during the economic downturn, and how that makes it worse.
Yeah, if you look at the peer-reviewed original research, you really see a very consistent finding between the strength of safety nets and subsequent stimulus. It's actually rather uncontroversial in the academic literature, but in the policy space, there's a lot of more pejorative terms and ideologies at play. And the reason for it is quite simple. So a lot of what we see in the public space are sort of ways that people lie with statistics. That is, for example, they say, well, we're spending so much on welfare as a percent of GDP. What's the problem with that statistic? You know, I teach my statistics fellows, my postgraduate fellows. Your denominator is moving at the same time as your numerator. That is, GDP, by definition, is going down during recession. So even if you spent the same amount of money, dollars over GDP is going to increase, right? Your denominator has decreased. it's a nice way of showing a graph that's very scary, but is essentially a statistical lie or deception. And similarly, you have what's at play called automatic stabilizers. That is, during periods where there's more poverty and more unemployment, you naturally get more demand. For example, on Medicaid, as people lose employer-sponsored health insurance, or on food stamps, as people become poorer. That doesn't suddenly mean that people are permanently on welfare. In fact, what you see in the data is that the amount of people on food stamps corresponds perfectly to the amount of people in poverty. But more importantly, you also see a shifting of what people can spend. So when people go onto food stamps, you see an incredible ability for people to be able to maintain jobs and also consumer spending and subsequent stimulus, and less of these kinds of what we call heat or eat dilemmas, that people either can pay for eating or they can pay for food but not both, which seem to correspond to later healthcare outcomes as they get sicker, and they cost a lot more,
right.
And also correspond to short-term stimulus because they can spend the money they're earning.
Right. You're also losing a whole generation of young people who are hungry, who won't develop, their brains won't develop, you know?
This is the sort of, I'm giving you the calculus of the hard-nosed person who doesn't even care about the
No, but most system. Of the listeners are not hard-nosed calculus type people. They're more emotional.
And indeed, you know, as a physician, I have to tell you that it's dramatic, the kind of impact we see among patients who are on, for example, Medi-Cal or Medicaid in the rest of the country, and the kind of buffering effects they have because they have to make decisions about what to spend a very limited budget on. I honestly, you know, my motivation to co-author this book was purely because I did not find the stories of my patients were being reflected in the kinds of news reports I was seeing in newspapers, which were almost entirely focused on interest rates and the nature of the stock market.
Mm-hmm.
But that, I do not think, is a major important story here.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of how people are affected by this recession.
No, we're losing the next generation of young people. I mean, we have so many working poor in this country. People lose their food stamps because they get a job that's minimum wage, and now suddenly they don't qualify, and now they can't even buy food, and their children are in school, and there are hardly any school programs anymore, and they're just hungry, and they're not. This is a developing brain with no protein and no food density, no nutrients, and the obesity epidemic seems tied in addition to the fact that cheap foods are sugary fast foods and sodas. So you find these extremely obese people who are actually malnourished and starving. So we're destroying our next generation. So it's hard to breathe when you listen to the news and you hear more and more of this clamping. In fact, we're looking at the UK now is the National Health Service is being co-opted by the right wing in the UK, and they're trying to dismantle the system, you know, and this at a time when there is a global economic downturn. Let me just I just realized I need to say, this is Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman. I'm on the phone today with Sanjay Basu, who has co-written The Body Economic. But so go ahead, if you would.
Yeah, you mentioned the UK NHS, and many of us in public health find it deeply ironic that the National Health Service, which was celebrated during the Olympic opening ceremony as a pride of the country, is now essentially being privatized through a number of contracts that are dismantling it. And during the course of the recession, we found that as a universal healthcare system, the people in the UK receiving the NHS were actually dramatically buffered from adverse healthcare outcomes, unlike those in the United States, for example, but and at a better cost per better outcome. So they were getting more bang for their buck, as well as getting better overall outcomes. But the ideology has very much been to mimic the U.S.-based healthcare system in spite of all the incredible amount of data suggesting to do otherwise. And already the health outcomes and the economic outcomes have been worse. People have been dramatically overcharged. So certainly there's a group of private companies who are making quite a bit of money now. on what had been the public system, but also the health outcomes and the economic outcomes are dramatically worsening.
Yeah, we actually have a friend from the UK who has a chronic illness, ataxia, and he said that the doctors were interested in him at first, and then when he failed to thrive, they just stopped really doing anything. So their system has become like our managed care system, which is to manage, not to care. We haven't talked about suicide. Suicide is, of course, a very horrible and dramatic consequence of economic downturns. And it's complicated why it happens. It isn't just that somebody lost their house and they're ashamed or they can't take care of their family. Some of it is also because they're unwell. I mean, they're not functioning anymore, and they're at their wit's end. So, you know, maybe this is an opportunity to talk about the White Widows of Italy and how to avoid this in other countries like Greece and places else.
Yeah, you know, our first rule in statistics is that correlation is not causation, and the relationship between unemployment and suicide shows just how dramatically assuming correlation is causation can lead you to a wrong conclusion. So in many places, unemployment increases do lead to increase in suicide. For example, in the United States, where during this recession we've seen about 4,700 increased cases of suicides above and beyond the pre-existing trend during the recession. But if you really closely look at the data, you see that suicide and unemployment are not correlated well everywhere. And this is another kind of natural experiment. You see why different policies in different places can lead some populations to be more resilient than others. So, for example, in Sweden, we observe during huge unemployment spikes, such as during their banking crisis and recessions of the early 1990s, we saw actually a continuing decrease of the suicide rate, and asked the question of how was it that in spite of a massive spike in unemployment, they were able to prevent suicide increases. And by doing a number of studies through very large randomized trials, we were able to find that there was a strong protective effect of what are called active labor market programs, or ALPs. And what these programs are is sort of part carrot and part stick. When someone becomes newly unemployed, they get a social worker, a case manager, who essentially helps them with working with their firm, their former firm, and working with them both for job skills retraining and for getting at least part-time employment rather rapidly. And the stick part is that they sort of have to do it, otherwise they don't get unemployment benefits. And so rather than being, it's far more effective, for example, than just getting an unemployment check, where you see a lot of people sort of spiraling into further depression. It's also more effective than just having a case manager alone, because it is quite a supportive environment. And in some large randomized trials, including some that have been started here now in Michigan and Detroit, one sees that in addition to providing a local economic stimulus by improving the condition of jobs and reducing unemployment, you also, as a side effect, have public health benefits in terms of reduced alcoholism, depression, and suicide from these programs.
Well, and also, as I said before, if you're not feeding people, if they don't have food, and their nutrient status drops, and you're dealing with terrible nutrient deficiencies, you're going to have horrifying depression and things like that. And they're just kind of left out there, too. So it's really frightening. The other unintended consequence of these shock therapy austerity programs and losing the social programs and losing all of that is that you also start having things like you stop spraying for material. Well, I don't know about spraying, but in this country we use pheromones or anyway, there's no attempt to control vectors. And so you see an increase in West Nile, and you see malaria suddenly in Greece. And we've also mentioned the HIV increases of HIV infections and all this. So the other just really straight across health consequence of recessionary austerity measures is without the social programs, the people on the outer edges are going to get sick. And when that happens, you end up with pandemics.
Yeah, it's a common rule of epidemiology that it's very hard to predict an epidemic. We're very bad at it. It's like predicting an earthquake. And the reality is that there's a lot of ways in which preserving a healthy community has indirect benefits for our health that are very potent. For example, you know, during the 1990s, there were some famous studies that said, suppose everyone in the United States had perfect health insurance and a perfect doctor, and how much of the preventable deaths among young people, people less than 75 years of age, could be averted in the United States. And preventable was defined by a panel of doctors who said, look, these are very easily treated conditions that no one should die from if they had good health care access, like a common infection. And it turns out that the answer was only about 15 to 20%. So where is the other 80 to 85% coming from? It has nothing to do with pills, because health doesn't start on my exam table or in the intensive care unit. It starts at home and in the neighborhood.
Right, the environment.
And the quality of air that you breathe or the food that you eat and whether you smoke or drink too much.
And your social environment.
Exactly, which is why one of the best statistical predictors of your life expectancy is your zip code. Not because the actual number matters, but because it's a correlate. It's capturing a lot of other social and environmental and economic factors that are bigger determinants of your health than your doctor is. And the reality is that we see this time and time again, especially during periods of vulnerability like recessions. For example, in Bakersfield, California, where there was really an epidemic of foreclosures, we had yet again an unexpected epidemic. A lot of abandoned homes had stagnant water as mosquito breeding grounds. And so there was one of the largest outbreaks of West Nile, even though it was a dry season. Similarly, in Greece, after cutting the malaria and HIV prevention budgets, we had the first large epidemic of malaria. And, you know, the State Department didn't know what to do with themselves because they were used to providing American travelers with warnings for Africa, Latin America, and Eastern Asia for malaria prevention. And now they had the diplomatic conundrum of having to send out a warning to Americans traveling to Western Europe that they might be vulnerable to malaria. And similarly, the HIV increase in Greece has been dramatic as those specifically austerity regions, but not in the non-austerity regions, one saw decline in the HIV prevention budget as particularly needle exchange programs, and the youth who are facing a 40% to 50% unemployment rate began using heroin and a number of other newer methamphetamine derivatives, and there's a dramatic tenfold increase in HIV infections among that group.
Yeah, we haven't learned much since the cholera epidemic, apparently. Or we learned, but when money gets scarce, suddenly it gets thrown out. Dr. Abashu, I'd like to close with the solutions that you and Dr. Stickler have recommended.
Yeah, I think, I'm required as a doctor to first do no harm. And I think what is dramatic about the experiment that's taken place during this recession, as certain communities have been faced with austerity while others have received stimulus, is sort of an experiment without informed consent, and it's an experiment that's failed. And if we applied our physician's mantra of first do no harm to our economic and financial policies, I think we would be a lot safer. We wouldn't be experimenting with whole communities this way. The other recommendations are really pretty well established in the peer-reviewed academic literature. These active labor market programs that help people get newly employed once they're unemployed seem to have profound public health benefits as a side effect. And preserving our nation's real defense system against epidemics, that includes the Centers for Disease Control, but also our local public health departments, at times of recession is really quite critical.
Yeah, so local stuff, even if the government's not doing the right thing locally, try to do it.
We certainly learned that in New York City in the 1990s when tuberculosis budget was cut. We had a drug-resistant outbreak of tuberculosis that cost over 10 times more, over $1 billion to bring under control. And so, you know, the old adage that prevention is better than cure also applies to prevention being cheaper than cure when it comes to public health.
And lastly, since we're having, I think, the hottest year in history all over the world, I would say that climate change is another area where during austerity, or that austerity measures attempt to curb, you know, that during economic downturns, there's, oh, well, we can't afford to rein in business because, you know, it will ruin the economy. So I would think that the climate disaster that we're experiencing is another health effect of austerity.
We haven't even begun to scratch the surface of how climate change affects public health, but everything we're seeing suggests that it makes one more vulnerable to certainly vector-borne diseases, as mosquitoes and other vectors are able to transfer into areas they weren't in before. But also really supports the overall message of being cautious and careful with what we do. We have a precautionary principle in public health, which is that if a policy is controversial, we should always choose the policy option that is safest first.
I think I agree.
Something like chemicals in our water supply, and we don't know what its effect might be, one should first reduce our exposure to it. And similarly, in the context of austerity, when there is controversy about whether or not a policy may be a good idea, we should first do whatever is safest for us, not the most reckless.
Because cleaning up recklessness is very expensive. Yeah.
In human lives, which don't come back with the stock market.
Exactly so. Very well put. Dr. Sanjay Basu, who has written with Dr. Strickler, I hope I'm pronouncing his name right, David Strickler. Their book is The Body Economic, Why Austerity Kills, Recessions, Budget Battles, and the Politics of Life and Death, where we learn that what happens all the way across the world has rippling effects, and that taking care of people in the end is the way to improve the economy. I want to thank you so much for spending this hour with us, and I hope you're getting a good response to this book and to your message, are you?
Yes, and thank you for having me.
You're so welcome.
Indeed, I think so many of us who work in public health have seen the effects of this in our sector, and I think it's quite important to have a bit of a voice that's not just about stocks and bonds during the course of this recession.
I agree. Thank you for providing it. Again, thank you so much, Dr. Sanjay.
Thank you.
And I want to thank you all for listening. I'm Lena Berman. Visit our website, yourownhealthandfitness.org, all spelled out, for access to our 500 archive shows with our library card. Find out about our practice, a free stream of this week's show, our book, and lots more at yourownhealthandfitness.org. Contact us by mail, email rather. Email is admin@yourownhealthandfitness.org. Your Own Health and Fitness is produced by Lena Berman and Dr. Jeffrey Fawcett. Remember, being informed not only protects your health, it protects your freedom.